Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. You can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Today we're joined by Dr. Marta Chabotowska, who's a lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Aberdeen. Her research has focused upon Catholic sisters in Polish convents, Polish Catholic migrants in local churches in Scotland, and most recently she's co-written a book with Steve Bruce called Why Are Women More Religious Than Men, which is coming out later in the year, published by Oxford University Press. So today we're going to be talking about just that question, why are women more religious than men? So first of all, Dr. Chabotowska, welcome.
Hello.
I guess we should start by saying, are women more religious than men?
Yes. Yes. There's a whole mountain of surveys, so quantitative evidence, which focuses on mainly really Christian religions, but there's also evidence from the World Values Survey that covers the rest of the world. And as it usually happens with quantitative data, when the questions are translated into different languages, the outcomes might vary. So you could say that it's not entirely reliable, but so many people have reproduced the surveys in so many ways that you could say that if it's not universal, the gap, gender gap in religiosity, then at least it's close to universal. Mm. Then there's a lot of evidence from qualitative sources, so ethnographies of women's religiosity, and small-scale qualitative studies, historical studies. In other words, there's plenty of stuff. There's a lot of data from the Gallup surveys. That have been, the surveys that have been done over and over again over the years, and mainly during the 20th century. And I'll come to it later, but it seems like the question can only be asked now because we have had access to this data only over, just a bit more than 100 years. Mm. Because before it simply wasn't available because, people didn't pay attention to these things, to gender. So this is a very unique moment, and it's a very timely question, I guess, because we can actually ask it, we can access it.
Yeah.
So yes, they are more religious than men.
Okay.
Do you want me to say anything about how it's measured?
Please do, because that was my next question.
Okay.
Would be what do we mean by religious here, and so what measures are we using?
Okay. Well, I'm just looking here at a couple of tables that I have. And the questions that were asked were, for instance, are you a religious person? So that's obviously asking about beliefs and attitudes, but also about attendance. So how often do you attend church, mosque, and so on? And here we obviously come across a problem straight away, because when you're trying to compare different religions, you have to take into account that there are different rules. So what makes a good Muslim is not the same thing as makes a good Christian, and so on. And this is further complicated by gender differences, different requirements for men and women. So you have to rephrase questions. So for example, I've got, this is a brilliant example of how you can measure non-Christian religions in this respect. Because if you ask Muslims or Buddhists about attendance, men come out as more religious than women, of course, because of the particular rules and requirements that are placed upon them. But if you rephrase the question, if you ask Muslim, Buddhists and Hindus, for instance, do you consider yourself as actively practicing your religion? Then the answers will be different. And here women come out as more religious than men, and it's only Sikhs that come out on a par with women and men.
Yeah.
But everybody, in every other case, it turns out that women are more religious than men. Another issue here is what you could call primary and secondary religious behavior. If you asked a religious person about this, they would probably disagree, and they would say that all religious behavior or rituals and beliefs are primary. But we could make this distinction just for analytical purposes. So going to church and praying, or going to the mosque, or attending any religious place of worship, would be primary behavior. And secondary behavior would be all these things that you do daily that are connected to religion, but perhaps not explicitly.
Mm.
And here, there are fantastic examples of, for instance, the use of food in religious rituals. And Judaism excels at it.
Mm.
We've got the stereotype of the Jewish mama cooking, yeah. which is... as I said, a stereotype, but it is also true. And it is also true that these rituals that are sort of unnoticed, Grace Davey refers to it as I think she uses the metaphor of an iceberg, that you get there's all this stuff going on the surface, but you only see the tip of it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with women and religious behavior, because, as I say, Jewish women would carry out all these food-related rituals that are very, very important, absolutely central to the religion. So without them, this whole thing would collapse. But nobody talks about it as explicitly religious, as a behaviour.
Yeah.
They attach a lot of spiritual importance to it, and they in fact think that their religiosity is superior to this of men's.
Yeah.
It's not the intellectual effort that matters here, it's being good to your fellow human being. There's a great anecdote about it. It's a married Jewish couple, and they discuss whether it's better to give money to homeless people to buy food, or whether it's better to cook for them and give food to them. And the man, the rabbi, says that it's better to give money to them, and that's his charity. And the wife disagrees and says, no, you can't give money to them. They don't have a place to cook the food. You're completely ignoring the context here. I will cook for them, take them the hot meal. It will benefit them much more. And I'm performing an act that is essentially a religious, spiritual act, and an act of charity. But what you're doing doesn't make any sense. Because although... men and women are not as different as we think, there are still different patterns of thought and action. And this is a great example of how men and women can think sometimes in social situations. So what I'm trying to say is that women do a lot of things that are not considered explicitly religious by men, but they are.
Wonderful. So you're not just taking surveys and, if people are like, yeah, I'm religious, or yeah, I go to church.
Mm-hmm.
You're really looking into it in much more in-depth than sort of superficial.
Mm-hmm. I mean, having said that, that's one of the problems. That's part of the reason why we've written the book, is that we teach sociology of religion. And gender turned up on the agenda just about, I would say, 15 years ago. In fact, Tony Walter and Grace Davey wrote an article in 1998 that was, I think it was published in the British Journal of Sociology, about this question, about the gender gap in religiosity. And they suggested some tentative explanations that they gathered together. And it sort of went unnoticed. And then in 2005, there was a conference in Lancaster for the study group, Sociology of Religion study group, and the theme was gender and religion, and that's how it all really kicked off.
Hmm.
But Grace Davey and Tony Walter made this argument first, really, and noticed it, because the gender gap in religiosity was first really noticed by those involved in Christian churches.
Hmm.
So people who were around religious people and noticed that there were just more women.
Yeah.
And thought that was, or some thought that was a problem, some thought that was just a puzzle that was interesting to discuss. So that's why we wanted to write the book, because there weren't any sociological texts that would bring together all these studies of women's religiosity, but also there were quite a few arguments, explanations coined by various scholars from different disciplines. They weren't brought together, critically assessed, for undergraduates, really, or postgraduates who wanted to know something about it from a sociological point of view.
Yeah.
So, and we wanted to do it as a social scientific attempt, not something that is just exploring religiosity or, something involving a partisan argument, like a lot of feminist studies of women's religiosity. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's already a point of view put on it. It's already directed by an agenda. We didn't want an agenda. We want to, as sociologists, we want to describe religion, present evidence, and then try to explain the patterns of human behavior. And here it happens to be a very gendered pattern.
Yeah.
So that's, just gone off track. But
no, not at all. It's really good to get into the inner workings of what's going on. To move things on a bit, I remember... again, this is another interview that we're recording down in Chester at the British Sociological Association Sociology of Religion Study Group annual conference. So I attended Marta's talk yesterday. You mentioned, I think it was three major explanations as to why, sort of classic, if you could have classic explanations since it's only been such a short time, as to why women are seemingly more religious than men. Could we talk about that?
Yeah, well, we divided all the existing explanations into three different groups, just for analytical purposes and just for the sake of clarity, really. So the first one, as you would expect, would be the nurture-nature debate. So are women more religious than men because of who they are or because of what they do? And I think in popular consciousness, there's this belief that the women are biologically different from men, and it drives them, and it's just innate differences. And sociologists have been struggling for years and years to show, and not so much prove, but just demonstrate that it's not necessarily the case, and so did anthropologists. But anyway, so the first explanation would be, I suppose, feminine and religious social roles and activities. So we're talking here about secular social roles and activities that women are expected to engage in most societies, that also coincidentally involve religious activities. Because Christianity in Western societies is such a central part of culture and daily life, and has been, well, obviously less so now, but it structured social life to such a great extent that there's just no escape from it. So social roles and activities that are deemed feminine, so women are socialized into performing them and expected to perform them, and they also happen to be in the realm of the religious. So first, the first one would be childbearing, and that's explicitly biological, and that's the main difference between men and women, that men yet still can't give birth.
Unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, absolutely. And you know, maybe one day they will be able to, but even if they do, they will have a long way to catch up with women in terms of the practices surrounding it. So you could say, yes, it's it's a biological difference that really matters. But it doesn't matter because of some sort of innate differences. It matters because of the consequences of biology, because of the social expectations that are placed to women, because of the ability to reproduce. So childbearing is important because it's always been associated very closely with religion. So for instance, there are a lot of rituals, religious rituals, that were absolutely essential and surrounded childbearing. So baptism, the churching of women, so bringing women back into the church after they've given birth, in order to
make them clean again.
Yes, and also to give thanks for surviving birth, because as you know, it wasn't you could perhaps. I mean, a lot of women died in childbirth. A lot of children died. You would have up to, I don't know, 10, 12 children. Most of them might die, and you might die with them. And it was a dangerous business. So, and you would put faith into the divine rather than into science, because rationality wasn't as much around as it is now, and medical care. So that was the case for a long time. It's now an extinct ritual. It doesn't really happen. So that's one thing. Also, a lot of women consider childbirth, so new life, as a miracle. Even if they're not particularly religious, they assign some spiritual qualities to it. And it doesn't mean that it's an explicitly spiritual experience, but there's something about birth and death that obviously is absolutely central to all religions. And because women are so close to it physically and experience it, and an embodied experience is an extremely important element of it. So in the past, obviously, if you survived and everything was well, you would give thanks to God. Now you perhaps rely more on medicine, but there's still this aspect that's unexplained. Well, were you creating something out of nothing? Which is quite incredible. So a lot of women see it as a spiritual experience. But here, I've got to stress that these are women who already have a religious background.
Okay.
You wouldn't have an atheist woman who would suddenly decide that it was a spiritual experience, probably. I mean, maybe, but it would be a rarity.
Yeah.
Because you already have to have these templates in your mind in order to then impose them onto an experience and interpret the experience. So that's one thing. And then the consequence of it is obviously child rearing, so bringing up children. Women still are the ones who are the primary socializers of infants, of both babies, of young children. And it very often involves religious behavior, church going. I think in the States there have been quite a few studies that show that women go to church more after they've had children, and so do men, in fact. Because it's a family activity, and there's still a link between religious values and morality. Mm. And you know, to be socialized as a proper citizen in a particular context, you might go to church in order to make sure that your child behaves. Basically, a lot of people send their children to Catholic schools in Britain because they think it's a good thing to do, because children will be taken care of there and brought up to be good citizens. So there's still this association between morality and positive values and religion, and women are more likely to be involved in that, and it just brings them into the orbit of organized religion more. And then caring for the sick and dying, obviously. Again, I don't recall the exact statistics, but that women do constitute the majority of primary carers, paid and unpaid, around the world, everywhere. And also there's a history of it. Obviously we had nurses, we had shrouding women who prepared bodies for burial. And these were all jobs that were not really, you weren't trained to do it pre-19th century. It was something women just knew because they were socialized by other women. So in a small village you would have women who would perform this as a favor to neighbors, for example. And then, of course, it was masculinized in the 19th century. It was turned into a business, undertakers. Mm. It's very rare to have female undertakers now, although you do get them. And there are female-only companies who do this. For instance, in Australia, there's one that's called the White Lady. It's women-only, and a lot of men come to them when their wives die because they prefer women to take care of the body than the men. They just think it will be handled better because it's a female body handled by a female. So I mean, I'm extrapolating here, but but it's a good example. Midwives obviously is another example, but anyway, women end up being closer to these things. And then just general caring. We're not saying that all women are more caring, but they're more likely to care. And we don't know why that is, but it's, again, I'm talking here about statistical averages. So they're more nurturing. They seem to be more interested in looking after other people. And as I say, not all, but a lot. So they're more attracted to religion, or they might be, because of the message that religion sends out about compassion for your fellow human beings and about love. And it's expressed through taking care of other people. So that's the first explanation. So social roles and activities that seem secular, but actually are coincidentally linked to religion. And women are more likely to just to perform them. That's really it. The next one is risk aversion. Yeah. And this one is an American argument. I'll try to put it. It's very complicated. Every time I explain it to students, I get confused myself. I have to go back, so it's not a very good argument for it. But the basic idea is that all human beings are religious or have a need for religion. Just that's the starting point. So not believing in God, according to Pascal's wager, could be considered a risk, because if God exists and you don't believe in God, then after you die, you're not in a very good position. So it's safer to believe, because then whatever the outcome, you're okay. Now, studies have shown that men are more likely to be risk takers than women. Men simply take more risks. And again, there's the question of defining risk here, which is problematic. But it's been defined in lots of different ways. But mainly it's stuff like going, walking home alone at night, parachuting.
Driving very fast.
Driving fast, yeah. So things that you would expect to come up came up in these surveys. And it turned out, yes, women are less likely to take risks than men. So because women are more risk averse, they will be more likely to believe in God. So to bet the right way. on Pascal's wager, because rejection of religious beliefs is a form of risk taking. So women are more religious because they're not risk takers and they'd rather play it safe. And I'm not going to go into details because this is, as I say, it's very complicated. There's a lot of background to it. Then the question is why? Because we're still going back to, well, why? Why are they not risk takers? And of course, sociologists rush to suggest that it's socialization. Women are socialized to be submissive and passive and careful. But Rodney Stark, who wrote a quite detailed article on it, disagreed with it and said, well, basically, socialization is such a wide and complex concept that you would really have to try and narrow it down first or break it down into different aspects and then measure it separately. You can try to do it, but it's probably not very successful because it's just not narrow enough. And, you know, are we talking about children? Are we talking about teenagers? Are we talking about grown-up women? When does it end? You would have to be very, very careful at measuring it. So socialization too wide as a concept. And in fact, Stark has written an article about it and has analysed statistics to show that women in more liberal societies are actually more religious. Shouldn't be like this because they should be socialised into liberal values, therefore be less religious. But they're not. So societies that allow abortion and are very progressive in terms of gender roles, actually, in these societies, women are more religious than in conservative societies, which is a strange thing. And it's a very sophisticated statistical analysis of this that led him to these conclusions. But he basically, you could safely say that, you know, he disproved it. So then there's been an argument that it could be physiology. Men take risks because of high levels of testosterone and low levels of cortisol, which is a fear hormone. So men are basically less scared physiologically. And even Stark himself rejected this argument in the end as a sociologist, and he's really reluctant to admit it. But his point was that if the difference is universal, then the answer has to be universal, and biology would provide a universal answer. So that's the second argument, risk taking and irreligiosity. And finally, there's the argument that focuses on what is referred to as gender masculinity femininity scale, you could call it. So it's this argument that starts from the basis of saying that masculinity and femininity are gender orientations. So you can have men who are more or less masculine, or you can have women who are more or less feminine. You can have feminine men and masculine women. And of course you can imagine that this is measured using very stereotypical ideas, traits, whatever is associated with femininity or masculinity. But it's a bit more flexible because we're not talking here about men and women. We're talking about degrees of gender identification or attitudes. And this argument was made by psychologists. So here, religiousness is actually associated with degrees of femininity because it's femininity that is associated with religion, religiosity. The two have something in common. So it's the degrees of femininity within each gender. So according to this, feminine men and feminine women would be more religious than masculine men and masculine women. And this is probably the most flexible argument, and there's something to it, definitely. Now, another American scholar extended this to sexual orientation. So he conducted a survey among college students, I think, he claims that homosexual men and straight women will be more religious than straight men and homosexual women. Because you see what's happening here. There's this association with masculinity and female homosexuality and femininity and male homosexuality, which in fact conflates gender identification and sexual identification. The two are two different things. So it's, but because there's a statistical table showing this, I suppose this argument went unchallenged. I think gender scholars will have a lot to say about this because it's very rigid. Because it's basically playing on the argument of camp men being more religious, right? Anyway, so that's the final argument, that religion and femininity have something in common. And we think that the question can be, well, you can ask the question and phrase it as if it actually regarded some unitary social fact, but it's not, because human life is not an experiment that's contained in a lab. We have different aspects that come into play here. So we argue that it's a sum of small differences that all come together and all interact. So a number of social facts regarding different gender behaviours that all get together and interact and produce a particular effect. Have we got time still to go through them?
We do.
Yeah,
5-10 minutes?
So there are five of them, and some might be more important than others. The first one is lagged effects of secularization. So this is the idea that modernization undermines the plausibility of religion and the role of religion in the public sphere, because men were in the public sphere, they were affected first, and they left organized religion. They left churches first, so they were alienated first. And modernization also erodes traditional gender roles.
Mm.
So this means egalitarianism, and this means that lifestyle and life chances for men and women are actually becoming more similar gradually. We're not saying that equality has been achieved. We're just saying that it's moving
gradually. Happening.
Yes. So women may become more religious, and the gap might diminish or disappear altogether. The gender gap in religiosity. So lagged effects of secularization is one. Vicarious religion, respectability, and patriarchy is number two. So a lot of the time, women are religious because men wish them to be religious, quite simply. And women conform. Women perform religion on behalf of men very often, because in many religions, religious merit can be transferred from one person to another. So if your wife prays for you, you're fine too as a man, and you know it, because you obviously socialized in these values. So that's vicarious religion. Women do religion on behalf of men, so they feel responsible for other people, men and children, in fact. Respectability. Obviously, a lot of the time, women are held responsible for collective honor. They expected to perform morality, again, on behalf of men. That's connected to religion. So I mentioned this yesterday, the example of Protestant terrorists in Northern Ireland who were very proud of having God-fearing wives who would raise their children right, but they themselves did not exactly behave in a very loving and religious manner, you could say. So, but they wanted their wives to be God-fearing. It was important to them. So godly women raise children as ethical and moral citizens on behalf of society, I guess, of men. And women, as I said, are more likely to be primary agents of socialization, so they're just more involved in religion, so that's another element. And obviously all of this has to do with the way society is organized, which is still very patriarchal. So women perform particular roles that they're expected to perform, and they conform a lot of the time quite happily.
Just to butt in, you've been saying that women conform a lot. I can see feminists, you know, would not like to hear that.
I think this is what I was talking about before. You have to distinguish here between some sort of a political agenda and just describing reality.
Yeah.
Reality is that people do quite well at doing what you want them to do if they're socialized right. And of course you can reject it and act against it, but there are plenty of examples of women and men doing what they expected to do. Men conform too.
Yeah.
It's just that women are sometimes worse off than men in the bigger picture. So we know, you know, absolutely, yeah. I'm using the word conform, but I could just use a different word that I can't think of. And we're not saying, you know, we could use the word they're coerced. You know, we could use any word and they would give it a different flavour, but the gist of it is that they do these things.
Yeah.
more women do than don't. So the third point is control of sexuality, which is exactly to do with that. So all religions have something to say about sexual activity, what you can do with whom, when, and so on. And again, women are often responsible or held responsible for men's sexual urges. So they supposed to be camouflaged, kept indoors. They're responsible for male sexuality, and a lot of religions expect them to be. Even the ones who consider themselves liberal, it still happens. So that's one connection to it. But then women also use religion to manage their own sexuality and to regulate male sexual demands. So you can use religious rituals that seem oppressive to. Would seem oppressive to secular feminists to your own advantage. And this has to do with the whole question of oppression versus liberation, because secular feminists would say to a woman in a conservative religious tradition, why don't you just leave? If the religion, if it's not right for you, you disagree with so many aspects of it, why don't you just leave and be secular? And it's because these women think that faith is important to them, so they will ignore the aspects that they don't agree with, or they will try to get around them. And this is where a lot of women use these rules regarding sexuality in order to actually get their own way. But it's, you asked me yesterday if it was a utilitarian thing, perhaps. You know, and I don't think it's that cynical. I think it's just using, we do it in everyday life. It just so happens that these rules here are informed by religion. I always say to my students, who is more oppressed, a Muslim woman who's covered up, or you out on the town in a short skirt and high heels in the middle of the night? I don't know which one is more oppressed. So you can manipulate it, and so women actually find religious useful for these purposes. And you can see lots of examples in Pentecostalism, Orthodox Judaism, Catholicism, even lots of different religions. And number four is secular gender roles, and I'm not going to go into detail. I've already mentioned it. Basically, women are more likely to be involved in social tasks that are labelled as secular, but keep them closer to religious concerns. So life, death, caring, all the rituals surrounding that. And roles bring about attitudes. It's like when you're a farmer, you work outside, you're more likely to be tanned than an office worker. That's really the way it works. You just take on particular attitudes because you hang about with particular people who hold these attitudes. And so the ethic of caring actually aligns women with religious organizations because they have common concerns. This message of love and caring resonates with women more than with men for some reason. Okay, and number five, which I think is really probably the most important now, is the concern with body, illness and health. Particularly in holistic spirituality, in New Age spiritualities, a lot of these activities are concerned with physical and mental well-being, and women are heavily represented in these activities, over 80%, so that's a huge, huge percentage. Women are more likely than men in the secular context to be interested in self-help activities and health-seeking behaviour. They go to doctors more. They address their physical problems more readily, and they also do this on behalf of men. They take care of men's physical problems. They would urge their husbands or boyfriends to go to the doctors. And it translates into religious concerns as well. So because women are more concerned with bodies in general, alive and dead, again, I mentioned it yesterday, women are not very happy in surveys about being buried. They'd rather be cremated because they're worried about what happens to their body after they die. They don't want to be eaten by worms, whereas men don't really care about it. So women are also more concerned with diet, exercise and bodily discipline, which is central to many religions. So yeah, again, we've got this almost coincidence where things come together for women and religious people. So women are more likely to be involved. So that's number five. And as I said, you could say that this gap is temporary and it will diminish or completely disappear when women's lives begin to resemble those of men's. But it might not, because it might play out differently in different cultural contexts and religions. And we already see such a diversity of examples. That's it, really.
Yeah. It's been wonderful. It's really rich with data and really interesting ideas, and it is a great overview. And I you know, I'll hold my hand up and say I don't know too much about the relationship between gender and religion, so it's been really good to be having this discussion. Just before we close, I might just put you on the spot and say if you could sort of reduce the entire argument to like one or two sentences, you know, why are women more religious than men?
It's not about religion. It's nothing to do with religion. It's to do with, see, I can't reduce it to one sentence. It's the gender difference in behaviour and attitudes to life that affects this difference and then feeds into it. Because religion is so closely intertwined with everyday life that it will matter here. Yes, but it's not biology.
Yeah.
It's not biology. Okay.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Dr. Chabotowska.
Thank you.
Perfect. I shall stop that. Well, you've just been listening to Chris talking to Marta Chabotowska on the subject of why are women apparently more religious than men. And I'm sure it's going to be a controversial topic. If you have something to say on the matter, please get involved on our website or indeed on the Facebook page. Next week we'll be continuing with the theme of material and embodied religion with an interview with Kim Knott on the subject of space and location in the study of religion, which we recorded at last year's Spiritual Practices of Everyday Life conference, which was sponsored by the Religion and Society Project. But before that, we've got a response to Marta's interview by Erica Solomon, and that'll be going up on the website as always on Wednesday. And don't forget, our Opportunities Digest will be going up on Friday as ever. And that's all from us this week. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, Project RS. And if you use us on iTunes, please, please do rate us. It matters a lot to us and can help us take the podcast to a lot of people who wouldn't normally hear about it. But for now, and as always, thanks for listening.